From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA executive producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Welcome, Steve, and welcome, Kane. This is your first time joining us on the show.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, here are the issues. The political sway of former U.S. President Donald Trump over Republican Party politics was tested again in the most dramatic night so far in this election cycle as his preferred candidates faced off with Republican opponents in party primaries in key states. President Joe Biden declared that last weekend's mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, in which a white teenage gunman allegedly killed 10 black people at a grocery store in a racist rampage, was domestic terrorism. Biden briefly revived a long-running appeal for federal gun legislation, including a ban on assault weapons. However, Republicans oppose additional federal gun restrictions, and Democrats need at least 10 Republicans to vote with them in the Senate to overcome any legislative filibuster to pass most legislation. The EU's efforts to impose a new round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine appears to be tougher than expected, as a small group of countries continue to oppose a ban on Russian oil imports. Finland and Sweden have officially applied for membership in the NATO military alliance. Here in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, says the number of counties considered to be at high risk of spreading COVID has almost tripled in the last 2 weeks. A new Gallup survey suggests many Americans are no longer wearing masks and social distancing, sparking concerns that ignoring health protocols will prolong the pandemic. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, high-profile battles were fought in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, while voters in Idaho, Kentucky, and Oregon also went to the polls. How will these primaries shape the Republican and Democratic parties as we look ahead to the midterms?
All of the primaries are being watched for two things. One, how strong a grip does former President Donald Trump have on the Republican Party? He has endorsed candidates across the board in many, not just at the very top of the ballots, but many down ballot and in many statewide only elections, he's endorsed some candidates. So we're watching that. And we're also watching on the Democratic side, which part of the Democratic Party is going to be stronger in this election cycle, the progressive side or the more moderate side. And we're seeing in many of these primary elections that on the Republican side, Trump still has a hold on the party. And on the Democratic side, the progressives are making some gains against the moderates. So that's what we're seeing so far and what we're looking at so far.
Yeah, former President Donald Trump wants to make this midterm election race and the primary races that lead up to that a referendum on him. And I think with maybe a couple of notable exceptions, he's proving that he does have influence on the Republican base and on the voters who are turning out for these primary elections, with the exception of a congressional race in North Carolina. That's Madison Cawthorn. And then also the Idaho governor's race. The lieutenant governor in Idaho was a Trump-backed candidate, and she was defeated in the primary race there. But other than that, I think many of the candidates that Donald Trump has publicly endorsed have been successful in reaching those Republican-based voters who vote in those primary elections.
One of the things, though, in many of those victories, not all of them, but many of them, especially the ones where there are multiple candidates in the race. Let's take a look at Pennsylvania, for instance. In Pennsylvania, we have a television doctor, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is slightly ahead of former hedge fund CEO David McCormick, both of whom are Republicans, both of whom appealed to Donald Trump for his endorsement, asked Trump to give his endorsement. And there was another candidate who also parroted a lot of former President Trump's lines about elections and fraud in elections and appeared to be very, very conservative. So there was basically a three-way race in Pennsylvania. Dr. Oz got Trump's endorsement about a month or so ago. And so far, he's got a very slight lead over McCormick. And the third candidate, Kathy Barnett, is also running strong. So there's almost a three-way split in the votes. And if you look at other races so far this primary season, Trump-backed candidates in a multiple, if it's more than one candidate, are only getting about 30 to 33% of the Republican vote in these primaries. While Trump-backed candidates are maybe winning, they're not necessarily getting a majority of the votes among Republicans. So that's something that we want to watch through the rest of the primary season.
Also, too, the claims of election fraud continue in these primary races, unfounded claims, illegitimate claims of election fraud from the 2020 presidential election. And this three-way race that Steve has mentioned in Pennsylvania right now is so close that it could, in fact, trigger a recount in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's election code requires the Secretary of State to order all county boards of their elections to conduct a recount if the leading candidate isn't ahead by 0.5%. And that's how close it is in those races there. So what's going to wind up happening if the results, when they're tallied, don't give a candidate a lead of more than 0.5%, there's going to have to be a recount. And I think that's only going to fuel these unfounded and inaccurate claims of election fraud. And some of that's already starting to bleed into the results as they're being tallied here over the last couple of days.
When you look at races such as the one in Pennsylvania, where it is very, very close, what is that really saying about voters? What are voters looking for in these candidates?
Well, we have to remember that typically in these primary races, it's the party faithful that turn out to vote. You know, this is not an election that's indicative of, say, a presidential election when, you know, the general population, the most amount of voters turn out to vote. So these are highly motivated, in many cases, political partisans who want to make sure that their candidate is the one who is represented heading into a general midterm election for the Senate and congressional races that are up this year. It's reflective of the party base, the voters of that party, but it is not necessarily reflective of the general electorate in those areas, such as those states or those congressional districts. So, you know, turnout in these elections won't be as high as they might be in the general election for these midterm elections in November, and certainly not like they would be in a presidential election.
One of the things that we're noticing is those people who are, quote, never Trumpers, who oppose Donald Trump within the Republican Party, are losing. They are not winning their races for the most part in these three-way matches or these multiple candidate matches. What it's showing is kind of the fissures that there are within the Republican Party between those who support Donald Trump and those who want to move on from Donald Trump.
Another thing to remember here also is that, you know, there is some analysis that shows that we have become more polarized as an electorate, and even so within a party base. So Steve just mentioned never Trumpers, and that would be a faction of the Republican Party that simply will never vote for Donald Trump or accept Donald Trump's brand of politics, which also is sometimes referred to as Trumpism. But there is some indication, especially in the results of the 2020 presidential election, that there are many of those people who might describe themselves as a never Trumper that have moved to the Democratic Party. These people, they might have voted Republican in the past, but were turned off by Donald Trump. Well, they're not voting in these Republican primaries now. They could either be voting as a Democrat in the Democratic primaries, or they're independents who might just be waiting to see how these primaries shape up, and they will vote in the midterm election and then obviously in the general election. It's also notable to point out, and Steve, you'll have to help me out with the numbers here. I mean, I think Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election actually won the popular vote by more than 8 million votes. Am I right with that?
Close, yes.
And there was over 150 million votes cast, right?
Yes.
When we look at those massive numbers in a presidential election, these numbers, when we're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands of voters in each state or each congressional district turning out to vote, is not necessarily representative of how, say, maybe the next presidential election is going to shape up. But another thing that's also notable that I wanted to add, we talk about Donald Trump's influence on the Republican Party an awful lot. It's interesting because he's making news by endorsing candidates. But what we don't notice is news made by Joe Biden endorsing candidates on the Democratic side. I guess it remains to be seen whether or not Joe Biden's endorsement would either help or hurt a candidate as they're heading into the midterm elections, but certainly not covered in the news, or it doesn't make for television Joe Biden making an endorsement announcement or showing up to campaign for that person as Donald Trump does.
Yes, and also we have in Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman winning the Democratic Senate primary. So what does this win mean for progressive Democrats?
It's an important win for progressive Democrats. Fetterman was aligned with Bernie Sanders in the 2020 election. Sanders was Biden's chief competition and is a very progressive, self-described socialist. But Fetterman has got a popularity part of his appeal. He's a giant man. He's about 6'8", very imposing, tattooed and shaved head, and comes across as very much of a populist, almost in a way that Donald Trump did during the 2016 election campaign. He is going to be a very formidable candidate against whichever of the Republicans win. One other thing that I want to note about Pennsylvania is that there's a Republican candidate for governor, a guy named Doug Mastriano, who is a state senator. He is an unabashed believer in Trump's false narrative that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. A few days before the primary election, Trump endorsed him once he saw he was likely to win. The importance here is that whoever is elected governor will have a say in how the 2024 election, presidential election, turns out. And Democrats are so sure that this guy, Doug Mastriano, is a damaged candidate that they took out TV ads in order to prop him up for the primary for him to win. They believe that they can defeat him for governor.
I want to dovetail on something that Stephen said about Fetterman's candidacy. So, in the interest of fullest possible disclosure, I'm originally from Pittsburgh, and that is the area that Fetterman is from. And he represents a very strong working class background. You know, he comes from a family that lived in an area where the steel mills were the primary employer of the people, the working class people who lived in the area. In 2016, Donald Trump appealed to voters in what we now call the Rust Belt, which is the industrial part of America that many people who lived there feel is forgotten. They were the workforce of America, the people who went to the steel mills and to the manufacturing plants to work, which have seen job losses, erosion of their workforce, erosion of union protections and union strength. And so Donald Trump appealed to those voters. He was the person who said, I alone can fix your woes and I can help you get your jobs back and I can help re-empower America. Fetterman, in this case, is that candidate. He is the candidate who can represent more of that idea to voters in the state of Pennsylvania. And he is not a Republican. He is a Democrat. If, in fact, Dr. Oz is the person who winds up winning the Republican primary, it'll be an interesting dynamic to see how all of these messages wind up shaping the race for the Senate seat in Pennsylvania and how much that's going to influence voter turnout.
Yes, it's really good analysis that you both did on these primaries that have been taking place. But want to move on now to our next topic. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden traveled to Buffalo, New York to mourn with the relatives of those killed by a gunman who allegedly drove 200 miles to the grocery store where he shot and killed 10 people. Biden called for U.S. citizens to unite against white supremacy. While many people lose their lives every day due to senseless murders, should U.S. citizens be more concerned about the shootings that are fueled by racism?
I guess I'm just going to be honest here and explain that I have covered too many of these myself as a correspondent for Voice of America. I covered a shooting here in Illinois. I covered the shooting of the Sikh community in Wisconsin. We continue to have these issues. And when another one of these incidents happens, it's like history repeating itself. And there doesn't seem to be meaningful solutions that address the root causes of these shootings. Yes, we should all be concerned. We should be more concerned. Americans should be more engaged and active in trying to prevent these things from happening in their communities. And it isn't really, you know, up to one segment, one community, one race, one gender. I mean, this is an effort that requires unification on the part of Americans to address it. There also needs to be a way to stop the radicalization of the people who engage in these activities online. If there was a clear answer to how to fix these problems, somebody would have stepped forward and done it already. But something has to be done. Somebody has to have the answer. Somebody has to come forward with meaningful action and meaningful solutions that can help not only prevent it, but you have to repair some of the damage that's been done between these communities. It's not just a matter of preventing it the next time. There has to be a tremendous amount of effort to help the country heal.
Unfortunately, this kind of gun violence has become just another part of American life. Most Americans do not own a gun. Fewer than 50% of Americans have a gun in their household. According to the latest Gallup poll, 52% of Americans favor stricter gun laws. 4 years ago, in 2018, 67% of Americans favored stricter gun laws. Now it's 52%. I don't have a really good explanation as to why that number has dropped so precipitously in just 4 years.
Well, also to Steve, to your point, that number has dropped while the influence of the major gun lobby in America, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, has effectively been weakened in that time. They are not as strong as they used to be. I think they were on the verge of declaring bankruptcy. They've become almost an impotent lobbying organization while they've had to sort out their financial woes. So that number has decreased while the influence of the chief lobbyist for the group has also waned.
Yet despite the decrease in the National Rifle Association's power, there still isn't enough political will in Congress to toughen the gun laws. As you mentioned, Kim, in the open, Democrats who want to strengthen the gun laws need 10 Republican senators to come over to their side in order to just get a vote on stricter gun laws. So it doesn't appear that Congress is going to act anytime soon. The shooting in Buffalo happened in a state that has one of the most strict gun laws in the country, and yet this stuff keeps happening. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that.
And I also think there is some indication that this shooter in Buffalo had signaled what was going to happen online prior to it occurring. There was also some troubling signals that he was exhibiting with his behavior in school and leading up to the shooting. The question now is, were some of the concerns about his behavior and his intentions dismissed prior to this tragedy? Is there more that can be done to monitor this kind of behavior and maybe have an intervention before things like this occur? I think that's a part of the discussion now that's being framed in the wake of this tragedy.
And it's a discussion that is difficult to have because mental health is not just here in America, but worldwide, is an issue that is difficult to tackle. Because of American culture, it is difficult to intervene in someone else's issues.
That is so true, and we'll have to end the discussion on that topic for the sake of time. And it's time now for a quick break, and when we return, why the newest round of sanctions on Russia may be tough to pull off. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest Correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Well, in our next topic, the EU's efforts to impose a new round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine appears to be tougher than expected as a small group of countries continue to oppose a ban on Russian oil imports. For instance, Hungary is one landlocked EU country that is highly dependent on Russian oil, along with the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Bulgaria has also reservations. So how is the EU going to get around these hurdles, especially with Russia continuing to make money from these countries?
That's a really good question, how the European Union is going to try and deal with this, because so much of its energy comes from Russia. One third of the European Union's consumption of natural gas comes from Russia. One fourth of the European Union's oil imports come from Russia. The United States, before all of this began in Ukraine, had been trying to get the Middle East and the Gulf region, Emirates and countries, to help backfill any needs that the Europeans might have. That said, getting them off of Russian gas, which is easy to transport to the European Union, getting them off of Russian gas and oil is going to be an even longer process. And now that the Ukrainians seem to be at least holding the Russians to a stalemate, if not winning the battle on the field, it may be a little bit longer before the European Union's, especially those countries that you mentioned, give in to a Russian oil embargo.
I think right now what the plan is, at least on the part of the European Union, is you can't turn off the tap instantly and all at one time. It looks like the European Union is gravitating towards a sort of phased or oil embargo in which it tries to gradually shrink Russia's energy income. I guess what the European Union is hoping to do by doing this, it's going to be phased pain, so to speak, in trying to figure out how to deal with the loss of those imports. It won't all happen at one time. There could perhaps be an effort to find different sources of production for that. That's the difficulty, though. I mean, right now, when you have an established route and you have established means to get it there, it's not just easy to turn off the tap and redirect the supply from somewhere else.
Finland and Sweden have officially applied for membership in the NATO military alliance. So what will these two countries bring to the table?
The seismic change in the makeup of NATO. Finland and Sweden have been neutral throughout the Cold War, effectively, and joining NATO from Russia's northern border, almost to its southern border with Europe, it will primarily contain NATO countries, with the exception now of Belarus and Ukraine and Georgia. This is exactly what Vladimir Putin did not want to have happen, you know, at least publicly that he stated is why he was invading Ukraine. And so now to have this happen, it definitely changes the order in Europe, I guess, to protect Europe from future aggression by the Russians.
Especially in Finland, which adds another 1,300 kilometers of border that Russia now has with NATO. And Finland fought a war against Russia back in the late 1930s and ceded some land to the Soviet Union in order to end the war. They see that possibility that Russia will look at Finland much the same way it looked at Ukraine, that Russia used to have parts of Finland, and Finland, I think, was really spooked by the attack on Ukraine and believed that it was vulnerable. I see this as a big gain for NATO and yet more losses for Russia.
For both Sweden and Finland, this decision to join NATO happened at striking speed. There's been very little public discourse about it or general debate about their membership in it. It happened very quickly, and it's moving now in a process that's also moving along very quickly. It just shows how concerned these countries are about their security.
Absolutely. And I wanted to get our last topic in. Health officials report a spike in the new Omicron subvariant of COVID cases here in the U.S. So I just wanted to quickly get your thoughts on this new spread of COVID. The people I've talked to, it's a personal decision on whether they are wearing a mask or not, or to practice social distancing.
Here in the Midwest of the United States, and particularly in the state of Illinois where I live, we've had some of the most strict mask mandates and COVID protections put in place in the previous 2 years. It was about 2 or 3 months ago that the mask mandate here in the state of Illinois was lifted. I can tell you just by where I live, the general feeling among the population here is that it is a personal choice. I think there's a lot of people who are just unwilling to be forced to wear a mask or to curb their activities or to prevent from large public gatherings. And I think the mentality here has shifted from one of protection to one of management, meaning that if you're concerned about contracting COVID, the personal decision you have to make is whether or not you engage in public activities or put yourself in a crowd or put yourself into a position where you could possibly be infected. Again, too, they've just announced that there is a booster. The FDA has approved a booster for children ages 5 to 11. You know, that could help increase protection or at least increase the prevention of spread.
And after 2+ years of the COVID pandemic, many Americans are ready to declare it over. Unlikely we'll see mask mandates return anytime soon. I think the biggest number to watch right now is hospitalizations. It's at its lowest level since last August, but it's ticking up. And watching hospitalizations is going to be the real key to whether or not any other government mandates come down over the next month, 3 months, 6 months.
And we're going to have to close the show on that note. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA executive producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Thank you both so much for your insights and analysis on these challenging issues. I'm Kim Lewis, and on a programming note, we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening to Issues in the News.